Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Hey there, if you're listening to this and you support us on Patreon, you can hear it via the Patreon page ad-free. You're listening to Sound Opinions, and this week we're sharing some of our favorite songs about espionage. I'm Jim DeRogatis.
And I'm Greg Kot. But first, a conversation with the music legend John Cale. Much of our audience probably already knows who John Cale is, but for those who don't, his career as a songwriter, musician, and artist spans over six decades. It began with the Velvet Underground, where he played a crucial role in crafting the band's unique trademark sound. Several great solo studio and live albums followed, and he's dabbled in everything from drone to avant-garde to classical music ever since. Let's get into the conversation.
Well, we are thrilled to welcome to Sound Opinions once again, John Cale. Once again, how lucky have we been, Greg, that we've been able to chat with John several times. We even had a Sound Opinions donor dinner.
Oh, man.
That was a good night, huh, John?
That was fun.
That was a good night, yeah.
Mercy, wow. What a record. 10 years in the making. I hadn't realized that till I was reading some of the bio stuff, because I remember we chatted with you when Shifty Adventures in Nookie World came out, and now we have this new record that was ready to go, and then the world ended. got delayed.
Something like that, yeah. It took 2.5 years.
Yeah.
I was not sure I finished it, and after listening to it for a few months, and suddenly lockdown happened, and it was the wrong place to try and put this thing together. 2.5 years later, you got all these other musicians that are in the picture. The other artists that came into view, a lot of them I'd worked with before, Velvet Underground. I was familiar with a lot of those musicians. I was really happy to work with them again. So they all brought their own style with them. I was very happy about how they all contributed to the album.
Some great guests on here. Panda Bear and Avatar from
Animal Collective.
Animal Collective.
Yeah, they're fun.
You know, and Wise Blood. But, you know, what was interesting is Shifty Adventures, our conversation with you, you were really struck by some of the sonic textures that were happening in hip-hop. And this is a generalization, but to me, Mercy seems to be going back to some of your roots, almost, as a child prodigy, with a more of a classical influence. Would you buy that, John, or am I talking out my butt?
No, that's fair enough.
Yeah, it's got this incredible atmosphere, which really makes the songs stick together, even though you've got all these different voices on there besides your own, different collaborators. So you've created a unified work.
Well, they certainly helped, and they brought their own thing to the party. There's a lot of things on this album that I didn't have on the live album. So it's a lot of strings, for instance, which I hadn't written for in a while. And there's some kind of obscure musical ideas, like Marilyn Monroe's legs, for instance. Mm-hmm. I was going to write a song that never mentioned her name, but was all about her. It worked out well in the end. It just took so long to break out. I'm now thinking about it and seeing, what the hell was I doing for like 2.5 years?
But we're all saying that, John, after COVID. We are all saying that.
It was a disconcerting time. It was very disconcerting. Did you see that period? Because when I think about a song like Time Stands Still, that line, the grandeur that was Europe is sinking in the mud.
Not kind.
No, dark, you know?
Yeah, I'm okay with it because it talks about a lot of different things in the album. I wanted to say those things, obviously, because I worked the album. I talked about a lot of different things there. And when the time came, I kind of let it loose. I'm not ashamed of it. And, you know, it had a lot of other things in as well. I mean, some favorite people in there like Bowie. And when I look back on that, I thought it was someone I really wanted to work with, and I never got the opportunity to do it. Mm-hmm. It was weird. It was what was available at the time. We had a lot of fun together, but, you know, when you want to do some work and you're dying to do some work with one of your favorite musicians, you better get it done.
Be here now. Don't put it off. I was thinking, John, you said there's a lot of things on this album, and there is indeed. You're talking about the swing to the right, both in the UK and in the US. Some of these lyrics presaged the pandemic and certainly climate change, but it's not preachy. There's a timelessness. This could be Paris 1919. This could be the state of the world 2023. Unlike Unkind Shot coming here, unlike your one-time collaborator, Brian Eno. Boy, Greg and I were so disappointed by Forever and Ever No More. And it's like so preachy. It's like, wow, I didn't expect that. You do not preach. We have no preaching. And yet your finger's on the pulse of world events.
I couldn't get everything in, but I tried.
It would be a quintuple album if you got everything that's happening today. And yeah.
Yeah. It has good spirit in it. Mm-hmm. I didn't need to crack a whip to try and add more ideas. It was good that we left it at where it was. I mean, I'm happy with where it landed.
Well, you know, the reflection, you mentioned Bowie writing a song about the days that you were together with him in the 70s in particular, and a missed opportunity, it sounds like, right? Nico as well seems to be filtering into this music as well. So afraid of you.
Nico's a good example of how you've worked with somebody for years and you don't really realize how important she was in your output. What I realized when I was finishing off that song was how good her songs were. Her songs got better.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
And a lot of people sort of sat up and said, wait a minute, maybe we got to listen to this a little more. And that was really trying to talk to her and say, hey, when you first came to New York and worked with Andy, and your output became very tricky. Mm. As a German national speaking in English, at one point it was difficult, but on the other end, you did what Jim Morrison suggested you do, which is like, write your poetry. Put the poetry down first, then get the songs together. Mm. She was always saying that he was the one who's driving the train, and I think she had a lot of input from him.
John, I was wondering if you were aware of this album. We had a great chat with Chris Connolly, fellow UK musician, been living in Chicago a long time, who spent his pandemic with a labor of love, a double album called Eulogy to Krista. Songs from Nico's catalog and songs about Nico that he wrote originally. I was wondering if you'd heard of that, because it was...
No, I'm glad you mentioned that.
Yeah, Eulogy to Krista blew Greg and me away, right, Greg?
Yeah, it was an amazing record.
Concept record, real, spans her life. You make a cameo or two, of course, as a character. It's his version of Songs for Drella.
Yeah.
You know, what you and Lou had done paying tribute to Andy Warhol, you know, he has now done with Nico.
That's interesting. I mean, I'm glad somebody did.
Yeah.
I mean, we've done a lot of songs from the past that included Nico, but I'm glad that somebody else did as well.
Well, and you also paid one of the highest compliments to, I can imagine, to one of your collaborators on this record. Even a little passage in there where she's a dead ringer for Nico, you said, of Wise Blood. And her voice adds a lot. How did you come to meet this young musician and decide to feature her on Mercy?
There were several musicians that showed up that I kind of brought to the foreground. And she was in one of those concerts that we put together for the Velvet Underground and for Nico. And there were several that she appeared in.
Mm.
And she has a really deep voice, a very pleasant sort of enjoyable voice. That's not something you say about rock and roll musicians.
Many of them, no.
She fits in so well. I mean, it seemed like a natural choice.
I agree. The quality of her singing was really very beautiful. I was really glad that we managed to pair her with some of these songs.
You gave a quote, John, recently about the record, I think, talking about how some of the songs wrote themselves. I usually fight the more conventional songs, but this time I just let it all stay true to its origins. Interesting comment from you. It sounded like you didn't want to overwork anything in this record.
It's something that you want to let breathe and carry on and establish its own. You know, you need to have as much variety as possible in your artists, and we certainly had them.
You speak of the variety and the songs flowing. Did you write songs with artists in mind, or did it just sort of happen?
I did not. No, I'd written them all before we went into the studio. I came off the road and decided, okay, well, who would benefit from this quality of voice, that quality of voice, etc. And it was a very useful way of splitting the atom between all these individual musicians.
Seventeen studio albums. What a career. But it's inevitable when any journalist talks to you to go back.
Journalists, oh my God.
Journalists, I know. It becomes such a dirty word in 2023. There does seem in the last couple of years to be, once again, these surges of interest. They happen in the Velvets. It's not like there hasn't been interest from the beginning. But between the Todd Haynes documentary, and I had a splendid chat with him about his love of the Velvets and that film.
Yeah, he's great, isn't
he? You know, it sure is. And the Nico tribute that Chris Connolly did, and the exhibit that Greg saw of Lou's cocktail napkins and everything else.
Yeah, I was in New York and saw the Lou thing in New York. Yeah, Jim brings up a good point, the Todd Haynes Velvet Underground documentary. You're very much featured in that, obviously. You're an eloquent spokesman for the band. And I got the impression, John, that Todd kind of thought the band ended when you left, in some ways.
$26 in my hand. I don't know. I mean, I think with Todd, when I first heard from the producers that they'd chosen Todd to do the work, I heaved a sigh of relief. I mean, I was aware of Todd, and he knew about that era, and he understood what it was about. And that did it for me. He knew what to look for. So I just relaxed there. I mean, it was...
You knew you were in good hands.
Yes.
Where I was going, John, was your career on its own, these 17 studio albums, you know, but everybody always takes you back to this couple of year period. Is that ever get frustrating. I know you're extraordinarily proud of what the Velvets accomplished, as well any human being would be. But, you know, I mean, to me, Fragments of a Rainy Season, which was summing up your career on a live album, fantastic, Spartan, beautiful live album of, what, a couple dozen great songs. At that point, it seems like we could have Fragments of a Rainy Season Volume 2 now in all of your work since the 90s.
Oh, boy.
You know, those, I mean, the stuff that you've done on your own, you know, if we took the Velvets out of the equation, you'd still be a hero to all of us.
I was with you down in Acapulco, trading clothing.
There were a lot of people to work with. I mean, if you'd walked into the factory and on the first day that we were there, you would have realized how many of those people had talent and how many of those people exploited them. It was very productive. And all the people that were there had so much input on what was going on that it was also a place of great hilarity. I mean, you really just spent a lot of your time just laughing. And everybody there was out to create great music and great art. It didn't take long for it all to work together and gel. So those years were not wasted. I think that's what was in the background of Todd Haynes's approach, was to understand that, hey, we may be goofing around here, but we're also doing art.
I think the film was great in that it described the milieu that was around the Velvet Underground that allowed something like that to happen, the worlds of film and art and theater and dancing and fashion melding with the music and the personalities created this once-in-a-lifetime kind of scenario, right, John? I mean, have you ever been anything similar to that since then?
Yeah, I think everybody realized it was a once-in-a-lifetime event. Everybody there had a great time. And the music and the art that came out of there was pretty extraordinary.
Yeah. I should also mention that the words and music release, the Lou Reed stuff that you're on, you guys are in a room and making music and right before the Velvet Underground really became a band, per se. You listen to that early stuff that Lou was doing, it's folk music. It's kind of Dylan-esque.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, that's a nuisance.
It's a hard listen, that's for sure.
It's different, isn't it? Man, it's just like, you know, you go, wow, you got to that first record from that. It's almost hard to envision the leaps that were made.
It delivered more than it promised. What Lou and the band and I did were really fast moving. We wanted to get there ahead. When I was traveling back and forth to London to try I tried to get the songs for the first album in somebody's hands, in Marianne Faithfull's hands, in somebody's hands, so they could hear what we were doing. And whoops, you better be careful here because there are bands like the Small Faces and all the musicians that were there in London at the time. I mean, it was a real wake-up call. I ran into all the guys from the university that I was at. They said, hey, you got to go and listen to this. And so I went out and I got the songs and listened to them. And Small Faces was one of them. But there were some really great musicians and songwriters already there. And, you know, all we had to do was get out of the way. And I ran back to New York and I said, hey, Louis, you know, you got to change your mind about all of this. We've got to change our mind. We got to, you know, button down. And he did.
Well, with all this archival stuff, you know, words and music and the public library and the Haynes, you know, are you thinking, John, about what, you know, how do we remember John Cale 20 years from now?
No.
I didn't think so. You're about to be here now. Yes. This album. Yeah. Good answer.
I mean, I appreciate the sentiment very much. And I will. I always will.
You know what I was saying about Fragments of a Rainy Season, right? I mean, I had all those solo albums at that point when that collection came out. But suddenly, you know, I was gobsmacked. I thought of those albums as sonic pieces, right? And now I was like, wow, these are timeless, incredible, great songs.
Yeah.
You know, John Cale's a great songwriter. Nobody ever says that. Yeah. Lou wrote the songs. Cale did the noise and the art and the vision. But damn, you know, and there are great songs on everything you have done in the last 20 years as well. M Fans and Shifty Adventures and Mercy especially.
Yeah, we tried. And if you understand what your role is and how much stuff you've still got to put together, then you don't sit on your laurels.
It seems like your career is an example of somebody who's never said, you know, there's a formula that I need to follow so, you know, my fan base will understand what I'm trying to do. Like, I know on this new record, you've talked about using analog keyboards quite a bit and fretless bass, right?
Were you going to these instruments to shake up the songwriting or think in a different way?
Yeah, more or less. You just try a whole bunch of different things and see which ones really, really strike you as being potentially an accurate representation of your songwriting. If you don't find it on the first go, you can find it on the 10th. Mm-hmm. And you just get on with it.
Well, always a pleasure. Thank you, John. Congratulations on Mercy. It was worth a decade's wait, for sure. Yeah.
Thank you very much, guys.
Thank you, John.
You want to go to lunch?
Virtual lunch, yes.
Yeah, right.
That wraps up our conversation with John Cale, and now we want to hear from you. Share your opinion via voice message on our website, soundopinions.org. Coming up next, espionage songs on Sound Opinions. Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island. Since 1988, Goose Island has been brewing award-winning beers in Chicago that are inspired by this city. Take 312 Lemonade Shandy, Tropical Beer Hug Double IPA, and a rotating series of hazy IPAs only available in Chicago. You know, every time we go down to Goose Island, there's another one that they're pushing on us.
That's right.
They're all good.
Absolutely. And what supporters of musical culture, you know, in the city of Chicago and elsewhere, if you go to a show in Chicago and you see that Goose Island sign, you know you're in good hands. They're music fans as well as great beer makers at Goose Island. So we're really proud to be associated with them.
The Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago's beer.
Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island. Since 1988, Goose Island's been brewing beers in the spirit of Chicago.
You can find IPAs, Lemonade Shandy, and limited releases in-store or at one of Goose's venues in Chicago. Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago's beer.
And we are back. This week, we decided to share some songs. Well, let's say we were inspired by certain foreign objects floating over the continental United States a few weeks ago, right, Jim?
The Chinese spy balloon was one inspiration I had. Usually, Ace producer Alex has this long list of potential list shows, but I really wanted to do great songs about spies because I'd just been fascinated by the balloon story. Number two, did a deep dive binge with Carmel of Le Bureau, a fantastic French spy series, 5 seasons, that's about a decade old now. And then finally, speaking of John Cale, post-punk era, just after the punk heyday, he had a record label in New York, Spy Records, that he funded and released the single by Lester Bangs, Let It Blurt.
Yeah. So you're going to start us off, right?
I'm going to start us off. Look, you're going to do great pop music songs about spies. The only place to start is Secret Agent Man. You know, it's a tune written by P.F. Sloan, was one of the co-writers. The most famous version was recorded by Johnny Rivers. And there was a British spy drama, Danger Man, that gets aired in the U.S. as Secret Agent from 1964 to 66. So this business of like great foreign shows getting remade for the American audience or repackaged, it's not new. And Sloan thought, well, I'll take a stab. They're looking for a piece of instrumental music to start this show. Had that killer riff for Secret Agent Man, which kind of borrows from the James Bond spy theme. And that's the one they went with. And then eventually they had to flesh out the rest of the song, gets released as a single eventually by Johnny Rivers, becomes a big hit. I mean, it's just instantly recognizable for people of a certain generation. It sounds like spies running around, cloak and dagger. And, you know, interestingly, Secret Agent Man, Patrick McGoohan, was Danger Man, right? And then, of course, he makes The Prisoner, which is part two, the surrealistic realization of what becomes of spies. You know, there's very few spies that have a happy ending.
Yes.
But this song makes me happy. Secret Agent Man by Johnny Rivers.
There's a man who leads a life of danger. To everyone he meets, he stays a stranger. With every move he makes, another chance he takes. Odds are he won't live to see tomorrow. Secret agent man, secret agent man, they've given you a number and taken away your name.
All right, my first spy song, Secret Agent Man. What do you got?
Well, that's a great riff, and Secret Agent is the name of the song that I'm going to play next. It's a completely different song, and it was written and performed by one Tony Allen, drum aficionados certainly know him.
Hero.
Afrobeat aficionados know him. Nigerian drummer and composer Tony Allen died recently, but left behind a huge body of work. In addition to his incredible contribution to Fela Kuti's 1970s band, one of the, you know, basically the inventors of Afrobeat, with Tony Allen as the fulcrum around which all the voices and horns and guitars and other percussion instruments turned. This track is from a solo album. This is a rare, not only the drumming on the record by Tony Allen is fantastic, but he's got the lead vocal as well. And it's a pretty sparse vocal from the east, from the west, from the south to the north. And he's talking about the idea that, you know, it could come from anywhere. And I really think this is sort of a wink-wink homage to Fela, because, you know, there was a man who was subject to surveillance and murder attempts by the Nigerian government for a good chunk of his life. They tried to silence him because of his outspoken political activism. So I think Tony Allen is sort of nodding to his collaborator and employer, you know, here in this particular song. So here's Tony Allen with Secret Agent from 2009 on Sound of Music.
I know I did do my mind. For their hands, dagger, don't stop me.
The great Tony Allen with a commentary on Secret Agent.
I could never get enough Tony Allen.
No.
Nor can I get enough of the Fugs, Greg. You know, I am a huge fan of this Lower East Side ensemble of dirty beatniks, as they were considered at the time, poets and provocateurs, Ed Sanders being the leader, but his right-hand man, Thule Kupferberg. The early recording, 65, 66, by the Fugs, apparently all done, much of the first three or four albums done at one crazy speed-fueled session. The way those early albums are divided up are insane. Lester Bangs called them proto-punk, you know, no punk rock without the Fugs. Overeducated, smart, sarcastic, insightful. Kupferberg wrote CIA Man. And this is at a time, 65, 66, when we are just beginning to realize the full crimes of our intelligence services. Mm-hmm. In the name of protecting us in the Cold War from the threat of communism, what were we doing, the Secret Service? Kupferberg answers those questions, asks them, and then answers them. Who can kill a general in his bed? Overthrow dictators if they're red. CIA man, right? My favorite verse, who can mine the harbors, Nicaragua? Out-hit all the hitmen in Chicago. Kupferberg twisting Chicago to rhyme with Nicaragua. It's a great song. There's some language in it that we're cleaning up. But the answer to every question the Fugs ask, CIA man, that's who can do it.
Who can kill a general in his bed? Overthrow dictators if they're red.
CIA man. CIA man.
Who can buy a government so cheap? Change a cabinet without a squeak.
CIA man. CIA man.
What a song. What a band. I just love the Fugs.
I love that. Yeah, the Fugs were great anarchists back in the day. Speaking of anarchy, Gene Vincent
was
a man who loved his anarchy. Bebopalula.
Proto-punk rock,
best
too.
Known. I mean, those records are absolutely insane, those early rockabilly records that he cut. And, you know, lo and behold, he had a career beyond that. In the 60s, the Beatles absolutely loved this guy.
Yeah.
When they were performing on the Reeperbahn, he was with them on stage a number of times, and he was actually their opening act at that infamous, famous Shea Stadium show in 1965.
Yeah.
So just around this period, he was just about to hit the downslope on his career. He had a rough life. He was in the car when Eddie Cochran died in that horrible car crash, and Vincent himself was severely injured. This was circa 1960. And Vincent nonetheless continued to persevere. He was with a group called The Shouts. He had a number of ad hoc groups during this era, and a song called Private Detective. This song kind of is emblematic of the wildlife Gene Vincent had. He's basically talking here about making time with another woman, you know, even though he was married at the time. And he took her up to the apartment and then realized too late that she was a private detective working for my wife.
Ouch.
So talk about being spied upon, you know, gotcha, Gene. But he owned up to it. In Private Detective, Gene Vincent and the Shouts from 1964 on SoundScan.
I took her up to my apartment, put some coffee on to brew. I put some records on the player as the clock was striking two. That's when the sad news hit. Cut me like a knife. She was a private detective working for my wife. We didn't rock and roll no more. There came a loud knock at the door. There stood my wife with cops galore. I tried to crawl into the floor.
That is the late, great Gene Vincent. Died far too young in 1971 at the age of 36, but left behind some really crazy records, including that one.
Man, you know, there would be no private detective genre if you didn't have the obligatory scene of the PI with the camera outside the bedroom window, right? You know, watching. I'm going to a song about watching for my next pick, Greg. Somebody's Watching Me. Huge hit in 1984 by Rockwell. Who was Rockwell?
Yeah.
You know, Rockwell was a son of Motown founder Berry Gordy. They were on the outs, though. Dad did not want his boy dabbling in recording. That was for the pros. But when he recorded this song with some impressive help on backing vocals in 84, Dad came around and, of course, made a lot of money from it. It was a huge hit single. Who were those guys on backing vocals? Oh, yeah, Michael Jackson and Jermaine Jackson.
Yeah.
You know, it's a creepy song. And although the vocal tone is rather cheerful, there is this something like haunted about it, about being watched, about being spied upon. It was the only hit for Rockwell. He followed up with a single called Obscene Phone Caller, which I couldn't even find. I was like, and I don't know that I wanted to. And such was the end of Rockwell's career, okay? But, you know, you hear this song once in a while pop up on soundtracks, and it's always appropriate for the spy or the PI sitting outside with that camera looking at things he or she shouldn't be looking at. Somebody's Watching Me by Rockwell. Where is Rockwell today? That'd be an interesting story.
Talk about a one-hit wonder, right?
Yeah,
but man,
really.
I do love that song. It is good. I remember it was on radio all the time that one year.
Yeah.
Speaking of great songs that have had an enduring life, I Spy for the FBI. this was a one-hit wonder for an artist named J-Mo Thomas in 1966. And it was adopted by the Northern Soul DJs in England. You know, they loved the song. They loved those obscured soul songs from North America that were generally ignored here,
Dusty
but became
soul.
Hits in perpetuity on those dance floors. And you know, one of the bands that picked up on J-Mo Thomas as a result of the Northern Soul culture were the Specials, who recorded another one of J-Mo Thomas' songs on their albums. So J-Mo had this sort of career as a cult artist, but this song I think is his most enduring one. This particular song was recorded by numerous artists. Luther Ingram actually recorded it first, then later on a band called Blue Rondo a la Turk.
I love them.
John Hyatt recorded a version of this song, and the one that I'm going to play is by the Untouchables from the mid-80s. They were a great soul revival band during that era. They recorded a ton of covers, and none of them particularly well-known. But their versions were so frenetic and so energized that they gave new life to a lot of these songs. I got an X-ray camera hidden in your house, you know. Again, the Stalker song, you know, I'm coming after you. I spy for the FBI, doing J-Mo Thomas proud, the Untouchables on SoundCloud.
I said I spy.
I Spy for the FBI by the Untouchables. Great. There's actually a spy store a couple of blocks away from here that sells gear that I don't know if I'd ever want to go shopping there. But coming up next, we wrap up our selections for our favorite songs about espionage on Saturday. Remember in 2018 when Border Patrol separated thousands of refugee kids from their parents, deported those parents back to their home countries, and kept the kids in the United States? Believe it or not, 6 years later, there are still hundreds of families who have not yet been reunited.
Though we as a community may feel hopeless at times, we recently learned about an organization called Al Otro Lado, which works to reunify families. They provide holistic legal and humanitarian support to refugees, deportees, and other migrants in the U.S. and Tijuana through a multidisciplinary, client-centered, harm reduction-based practice.
Since 2018, they've reunited over 100 refugee families ripped apart by the zero-tolerance policy of the previous administration. Once reunited, Al Otro Lado helps each family find legal representation, housing, and the counseling they need in order to heal and get back on their feet.
Imagine having your child ripped from your arms and never knowing when you would see them again. We can't let family separations go on. If you're like us and believe that all families belong together, then join us supporting Al Otro Lado and donate today.
You can find the link to donate to Al Otro Lado in the description of this episode, or go to gum.fm/charity and donate today. That's gum.fm/charity.
You can also consider volunteering with the organization, which offers opportunities that are both in person and virtual. The best way to get involved is by filling out an application on their website, elotrolado.org/volunteer.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
And we are back. This week, we're sharing some of our favorite spy songs. Let's dive right back into it, Greg, with my next pick. I bet it's pretty hard. Given your encyclopedic knowledge of music, it's hard to come up with a song you've never heard. But I bet you've never heard of this one. Laurie and the Chameleons, The Lonely Spy. Now, this was a new wave band, existed only 79 to 80, formed in Liverpool, right? Had one hit, you know, it was The Lonely Sky. What is it about one hit wonders and spy songs? But there's a pedigree. In addition to the singer, Lori Lardy, who didn't go on to do much, this band had been formed by Bill Drummond, who'd already been in big in Japan and would go on to be part of that legendary electronic prankster duo, the KLF. And also David Balfe, who went on to the Teardrop Explodes and then became a record executive, A&R guy with Zoo and Food Records. He signed both Blur and your boys, Jesus Jones. Did you know that? So some great taste in evidence there and a great, wonderful Cold War kind of vibe to this song, The Lonely Spy. Again, we get a little hint of like James Bond from Russia with Love. And we get some great lyrics. The red square winds are blowing. Snow drifts from my feet. There's no way out of Russia when the iron curtains meet. KGB becomes the FSB. Still scary as hell, if you ask me. Lori and the Chameleons, The Lonely Spy. Chameleons. I bet you've never heard
that,
right?
No, that was a good one. I had not heard that before. And you're right. The one-hit wonders, man, with this particular area of music.
Maybe they all got, like, sabotaged by the CIA man that the Fugs were singing about.
Well, this is not a one-hit wonder that I'm going to play next, Jim. Desmond Dekker, a giant of Jamaican music for a number of decades. People probably best know him for the song Israelites. But prior to that, he was already making hits in Jamaica. And he sort of entered the fray, musical fray, in that era between ska and reggae, known as the rock steady era, you know. And this is a classic rock steady song out of Jamaica from 1967. He was using the metaphor of spying as a way to pay tribute to the Rude Boys, who are always dressed up, very, very classy, you know, kind of a... very stylish, and he used James Bond as kind of a reference point here. Okay, so 007, Shantytown, is a song ostensibly about a riot, and there were actual riots where the Rude Boys were looting and bombing and protesting the government, and the government was kicking their butts. I mean, the police and the government came down hard on the
as
Rude Boys.
Governments do,
yes, and but he admired the Rude Boys, not only for their brazenness and their bravado, but for the way they dressed. You know, they were kind of a version, as he said, of sort of 007, James Bond, that image of, you know, always looking your best while you're kicking butt, right?
He's shaken, not stirred.
He also references Ocean's 11, you know, the Rat Pack heist movie with Frank Sinatra and Dean Martin in the first lines of this song. So you've got a whole... another take on spy culture, this time from the fashion aspect of it. Desmond Dekker with 007, Shantytown on Sound Opinions. That is Des Dekker's 1967 classic, 007 Shantytown.
All right, Greg, for my last pick, I'm going to go with A Spy in the House of Love. Not the version recorded by Was Not Was, although we're going to have a little Don Was on the show in a minute. You know, the Was Not Was song, probably better known, came out in 1987. In 1984, the DBs, one of my favorite bands from that power pop era of the 80s, originally from down south, had moved to like the Hoboken scene, okay? Two of the best albums in the history of power pop. They debuted with Stands for Decibels and Repercussion. We've had them on the show. When Chris Damey and Peter Holsapple, to me, the DBs will always be those two, those songwriters, those singers, those guitarists. And you know, when Stamey left to go solo, Holsapple continued with the DBs and recorded what was going to be their first major album, Like This, for Bearsville. But Bearsville was in the process of going under, so it didn't get much attention. The Holsapple version of Spy in the House of Love, just like the Was Not Was version, you know, they both take their title from the novel in 1954 by Anais Nin, which I would never have the patience to even tackle a page of. But it's something about that literary mystery phrase, Spy in the House of Love, has inspired many great songwriters, including Peter Holsapple. Here's the DB's version of Spy in the House of Love from 1984. Someone should tell you. Did you know that one? You remember the
Yes,
Like This?
Absolutely. Yeah. I love that song. I had that album. I thought it was great.
It was great. It's not as good as the first two DB's albums.
Well, you know, it was Holsapple without Stamey, right?
Right, I mean, so, right. But, it's like Lennon without McCartney.
You still get good
Holsapple. Oh, genius, genius.
Last but not least, I wanted to pay tribute to the big boys, one of the pioneering punk bands in America out of Austin, Texas, late 70s. You know, they were unique among punk bands because they brought a little funk to it. You know, people blame them for the Red Hot Chili Peppers, but don't hold that against them.
That's a sin nobody should be saddled with.
But I love the Big Boys, because I thought they were just a fun band to see live. I mean, the lyrics were, you know, got you, grabbed you by the collar, but the music made you want to dance.
And well, and everybody, you know, we have so many friends in Austin from our decades going South by South. I mean, they were just revered in Austin, Texas.
Great band. And here's a song where they cop that Secret Agent Man riff that you opened the segment with, Johnny Rivers, right? They cop that riff here, you know, taking the 60s Spy Series theme forward. And this is kind of a song called Detectives, and it's unclear exactly who's stalking, you know, Mr. Big Boy here, but it is one of those deals where he feels like he is being watched, and he doesn't like it.
Yeah. He's like, I shouldn't laugh at stalking. You know, it's a horrifying thing, but in the context of detective spy fiction,
And I think in some ways this song presages the fact that, you know, corporations know everything about us now thanks to our cell phones.
Oh, man.
But they're talking here about this whole idea. History, you want to know all my history. You want to know where I've been, my life before and after 10. Yes, that's the world we're living in now. Yeah. You know, there are corporations that can tell us exactly what we're doing and what we like and what we don't like.
I get it. I go to the grocery store. I stop for 5 minutes in front of a product. I come home 2 hours later, Facebook ad.
Amazing
is
how that
being
happened.
Pitched. I mean, how did that happen? It scares me.
It's terrifying. So Big Boys presaging the future here. Detectives from 1980 on Sound Opinions.
Detective, you're acting just like a detective. You always got to see me. You always got to find me. Why don't you go away?
Oh, Detectives by the Big Boys. A good start and finish. Some nice synergy there with that riff, Mr. Cott. That concludes our favorite spy songs. And now we want to hear from you. Leave us a voice message on our website, soundopinions.org, and tell us your favorite song about espionage. Finally, we have to pay tribute to the late jazz saxophonist, Wayne Shorter.
That is a little bit of the tenor saxophone solo on the Steely Dan song, Asia. It is played by one Wayne Shorter, who died March 2nd at the age of 89. We wanted to say a few words about Wayne because of, you know, not only his immense contribution to jazz, but the fact that he did work with a number of musicians in the area we cover more frequently here, you know, popular music. He played on 10 Joni Mitchell records. Mm. Steely Dan recruited him. You know, they wanted the best of the best, so they got Wayne, right? In addition, brought jazz into the mainstream in the 70s, the fusion era, with Weather Report, which, you know, whatever you think about jazz fusion, listen to Weather Report. They stood apart from that whole scene in terms of not only their virtuosity, but the complexity of the songs, which they disguised very neatly because they were so melodic.
Yeah.
But with Joe Zawinul and Shorter, two graduates of the Miles Davis Academy, mm-hmm. Unofficial James Miles Davis Academy, you had an incredible band. Shorter started out playing with Art Blakey in the late 50s. Talk about an apprenticeship, right? And ended up writing songs with Blakey. Became part of, I would say, the one of the finest jazz quintets ever assembled, Miles Davis's quintet, mm-hmm. in the 60s. Went on to record with Weather Report. And then, you know, the immense body of work that he created as a solo artist, mm-hmm. during this period, too. His solo records are incredible.
Well, and I saw Herbie Hancock just singing his praises, yeah. you know, just as a huge inspiration.
Well, Hancock was a huge friend, and he and Wayne recorded countless records together. His contributions can't be overestimated. I mean, he was just such an immensely gifted soloist, but also a composer, you know, for Miles, for Weather Report, for numerous other artists. You know, he recorded with Milton Nascimento, the great Brazilian vocalist, on a record called Native Dancer in the mid-70s, which to my mind was like one of the first so-called world music records, fusing jazz and funk with Brazilian rhythms. So he was a visionary, a pioneer in many ways. We had a great interview with Don Was, who was the he was still, and at the time had just become the president of Blue Note Records, mm-hmm. and Blue Note was the label on which, you know, Wayne Shorter recorded some of his finest music, and we talked to Don about the records that meant the most to him. You know, the Desert Island. What record would you bring to Desert Island? Well, he hit upon Wayne Shorter. He talked about the 1966. Wayne Shorter's solo album, Speak No Evil, about what it meant to him and how important the title track in particular was because of Wayne's playing on it. And then we'll let Don take it away from this 2018 interview we did with him.
When I was in college, I was going to the University of Michigan in 1970. I was 19 and really miserable. I dropped out, and the best gig I could get was in a cover band at a bowling alley in Ypsilanti, Michigan. It was really it was depressing, man, and I felt like I was really losing my way. I lost sight of my dreams. I lost sight of who I was and what the mission was. And I'd go back to my apartment, and I'd put on side two of a record called Speak No Evil by Wayne Shorter, and I'd listen to that. And it was just really vibrant, man. But mainly I related to Wayne, and I was listening to his sax solo. And you can check it out. It's a song, Speak No Evil. What I envisioned was that Wayne and I were walking down a street, and he was kind of like pointing out obstacles to me. And like kind of helping me swerve out of the way. It's a little like a video game, but he didn't have video games in 1970, so I don't know what I was basing it on. The message of what Wayne was saying in his solo to me was, Don, you got to groove in the face of adversity. And it was incredibly helpful to me. And by the time I got to the end of side two, I remembered who I was, I remembered what my dreams were, and I felt back on track, no matter how crazy the rest of the day had been. The wild thing is that album still works for me like that. Mm-hmm. I got a long drive back from the Blue Note offices in the Capitol Records, the Capitol Tower in Hollywood. And if it's been a rough day, man, I can put that album on. And by the time I'm home, I'm feeling good.
Don was talking about Wayne Shorter. We're playing that clip to pay homage to this giant dead at the age of 89. Greg, what do we have on the show next week?
Next week, Jim, we're going to highlight a great band out of Illinois, Poster Children.
Yeah.
On the occasion of the bassist, Rose Marshak just wrote a memoir that is a terrific, terrific memoir of what it was like to be an independent rock band in America in the 80s, 90s, and beyond.
And don't forget to check out our bonus podcast feed wherever you get your podcast thingies. The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this program belong solely to Sound Opinions and not necessarily to Columbia College Chicago or our sponsors. Thanks, as always, to our Patreon supporters. Sound Opinions is produced by Andrew Gill, Alex Claiborne, and our associate producer, Sol Delgadillo. Our Columbia College intern is Lauren Holt, and our social media consultant is Katie Cott.